You're listening to On Margins. I'm Craig Maude, and this is episode 002. Something has happened in the last few years, and this is going to sound really obvious when I say it, but nevertheless, a transformative change for independent creatives around the world, you know, people like myself and many of my friends, has been underway. And this change is the normalization of paying for stuff. See, I told you it was going to sound ridiculous. And I'm not even talking about micropayments, you know, like the 99-cent apps around the world. But I'm talking about big bucks. $30, $40, $100 payments for books or behind-the-scenes looks at films or music albums. We are truly in the era of being able to leverage and build off of what Kevin Kelly calls the 1,000 true fans. Thanks to the work of crowdfunding and patronage platforms, this act of giving money to an independent producer has gone from esoteric and, you know, quite frankly, really tough 10 years ago to downright banal. Today, I'm talking with good friend, old buddy, partner in writing retreats, the designer, illustrator, visual essayist, and author, Frank Camaro. Frank was one of the first creatives to really capitalize on the rise of crowdfunding way back in 2011 with his seminal design book, The Shape of Design. We're talking today about how Kickstarter and similar platforms have changed, what we'd like to see added to them, and, you know, why we feel like there's never been a better time to be a creative person than today. We hope you'll join us. We are talking today about books on Kickstarter. And Frank, you did a book on Kickstarter back in 2011 called The Shape of Design.
True.
That was a pretty incredible project for a number of reasons, not the least of which you managed to pull in $112,000. This is back in 2011 with 2,109 backers, which at the time was incredible. I mean, even today, $100,000 for a book is incredible, but at the time it was really incredible. What prompted you, first of all, to do the Kickstarter, and why that book then?
Well, I had been looking at Kickstarter for about a year, came across the service because of you and your book, Art Space Tokyo. Our mutual friend Robinson, who also used Kickstarter for a book that he wanted to produce. What was interesting is that I felt like, at least in the community that I had access to, sort of the design community, the web community, everybody knew about Kickstarter and had maybe backed one, maybe two projects, but it didn't necessarily feel like at that sort of like critical cultural inflection point, anyone from our community had actually used it for anything. So that's what got me interested in doing it. The other thing was I had just given this talk at a conference in Belfast, Northern Ireland called Build. And I named that talk The Shape of Design. And basically it was just talking about design from a very high level, about the form that the work takes, the influence of clients, what client relationships look like, what design does when it's out in the world, all of that kind of stuff, based off of my experience teaching. And the response to that talk was so warm that I was like, well, let's turn it into a book, thinking that a 40-minute talk could translate into, you know, maybe a 120, 140-page book, something like that, if you go through and you illustrate it. So that was like the original inspiration behind it, was I've got this thing. I'd like to like put a little bit more meat on the bones. I think it makes sense to live in a book format. So let's go ahead and do it. Doubly so because I was writing more and I wanted to take on a new, bigger challenge from a writing perspective. And I had worked before designing books, so I knew how to handle the production. So I walked into it with a goal of, I don't remember exactly what it was. It was like maybe 22,000 or something like that. Thinking that, you know, I would probably sell 300-400 books, and I would just order a pizza, and me and a bunch of friends would sit in my apartment and stuff envelopes. And that would be like the new experience for me. It would be like writing the book and then doing a little bit of the fulfillment. Like the production of it was something that I had already had experience doing. So it didn't necessarily seem too intimidating to like make a first book off of a talk that you've already written, going into a process of producing it that you've already done a few times in your career.
Right. So, I mean, you kind of understood the parameters of what you're getting into in terms of production, at least.
Yeah, exactly. And I had had some experience with pretty much all of the facets of running a Kickstarter project, because I had sold art prints through my website and done order fulfillment through that. I designed books before, and I just naively thought that writing a book would just sort of be like writing an essay, except you just do it 10 or 12 times.
Right.
It's not quite that simple. But
right.
was it? Yeah, that's how I got into it.
What was, I mean, when you say it wasn't quite that simple, what did you find to be not so simple about it?
The segues.
Okay.
And just sort of like scoping the ideas so that they're paced and ordered in a particular fashion where everything builds on top of one another.
Right.
It took a lot of time to find the form of the book, honestly.
Right.
Because whenever I just sat down, I was like, step one is just transcribing the talk. Every word that I say in this video, I'm going to type that word to use as a starting point.
That's good.
And I typeset it, you know, like at the size that I kind of thought I might want the book. And it was 27 pages.
But that could be great. But that could be amazing, right? Did you feel that that wasn't enough stuff?
Yeah. I mean, like I had a thought in my head about what a book was, right?
Right.
A lot of stuff on the cutting room floor that didn't make it into the talk because I had 40 minutes, right? And there was like a few videos in the talk and some other things. So I was trying to figure out ways to integrate that into it as well. You know, I was just kind of very anxious to take the pose of a writer, to just sort of step into this and say, this will be a very writerly book. And I don't think that I would like go down that path necessarily at this point. I would probably just sort of say, like, I'm a designer and a writer, so it's going to look like there's a person who cares a lot about images and can make images working on this book, in addition to somebody who writes.
I had a very intimate kind of relationship with the making of this book. You were sending me drafts of it when I was in California.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the things that I loved about the earlier versions kind of fell away. I mean, when you kind of tighten things up, when you take prose and you kind of polish it, sometimes you lose that like funny, folksy, weird, blogginess. I mean, blogginess is all about unpolished prose, kind of untight prose in some ways. I mean, it's what we love when we read great bloggers, connecting to this kind of intimate buddy tone. I remember one of the early drafts that you sent me, I think I was like on the first page. I remember that I got cut out of the final edition. I remember being very, very sad about that. That tone too is like in and of itself something really wonderful. Openness and vulnerability that some of the earlier drafts had was really kind of special. I thought that was very cool.
So some of those early drafts, they took on a contrapuntal structure, right? So sort of like Grapes of Wrath.
What does that mean?
It kind of means where you've got two different kinds of chapters. It's like you've got two different stories going or two different themes throughout the book. So, you know, let's say all your odd chapters are just sort of like random stories that stand on their own, which was what the first draft of the book was. It would be like a folktale or a small experience that I had. Mm-hmm. And then all the even number of chapters would maybe be more theory-based or more directly related to the topic at hand, which is, you know, design. So the early drafts were like that. And as I sort of lived with it longer, I became more interested in trying to integrate those two things. Whereas very early on, I was quite satisfied with just sort of saying, here's a thing, and then letting it stand on its own, and then jumping into something fundamentally different, and then sort of trusting that the reader would be able to make the connections between those two things. And sometimes it worked and it was like really satisfying for people. And other times, like, I swung big and missed. So I think to a large extent, integrating those things and like cutting out some of the folksiness and really polishing it, I think it was like a hugely educational experience for me. So what it actually did was I was working with my editor on this book, Mandy Brown. What happened was some of the really rough and probably like ultimately embarrassing and regrettable stuff got edited out. And it might have also shaved off a little bit of the spunk as well. I think in the long term, it probably makes it a little bit more of a valuable and readable book, but it definitely makes it less chatty. And that's something that I kind of think about continually as I'm like sitting down to write now, is trying to like dial in that tone, because there is a tone like there is an austerity to the tone of the book, which I think probably speaks to more than likely just the experience of a first-time writer for something of that length. You know, we think that books are these big monolithic presences in our lives, right? Mm. Like you never get to write your first book more than once, but you think it's going to like be the shadow over you, but it isn't. Like you just have to talk about it until the next one is done. And then you get to talk about the next one.
Right.
Yeah. You kind of lose the, not necessarily the ambition, but more of the assumptions that you think that a book needs to be. You can sort of like deflate it a little bit and make it more approachable.
Yeah. Well, and for you, how much is visual a core part of the writing process? Like when you're working on one of your visual essays online, do you start with the words? Do you start with a set of images? Do you start with just an idea, some words and some images? Like, is there a process there, or is it kind of a big soup of chaos that then evolves into something coherent and scrolly?
It's a big soup. Mm. So for me, there's the wall. You know, I have almost like this murder wall in my apartment with like, you know, like photos or like little printouts of quotes or things just sort of stuck up on the wall, and I'm trying to arrange things in groups.
How big is that wall?
Oh, it's not too big. It's probably, gosh, about the size of a chalkboard. You know, just like a normal chalkboard that you would wheel into a room. So,
and is it like corkboard that you have pins stuck into it, or what's the situation there?
No, it's just literally the wall in my apartment.
Okay.
And then I buy blue painter tape, and I've got a bunch of index cards.
Okay.
And just like stray printouts from my crappy little inkjet printer. And I just sort of go to town on it. And like sometimes it's up on the wall, other times I like spread it out on the floor on a table, and I'm just trying to sort out these note cards.
Right.
Because, you know, I have this loosely blurry idea in my head, and I'm trying to find the patterns and all of these things that I've been collecting that seem like they're related somehow.
Right.
So the meaning emerges out of that. So after that, I actually maybe write a little bit in just like a text editor, but I actually go into Keynote, because what it allows me to do is to get all the images and the quotes arranged in a specific order. And also I can nest them, you know, I can sort of create a little hierarchy. So it becomes almost like a visual outline for me instead of like a text outline that you would do in Google Docs or Word or something like that. And that works really well for me, because I can just sort of push things around and, you know, type up a quote, or I can do like a speaker commentary.
Yep.
There's presenter notes inside of Keynote. So I can just like write a full paragraph. And then once I have like a form there that I think works really well, then I sit down and I actually write out the thing in whole.
Okay.
And sometimes that turns into the presentation at, you know, the conference or the event or the lecture or whatever I'm doing. And then that also gets turned into the website.
Keynote really does kind of turn things into objects in a way that text editors don't. Like, and that sort of invite you to move things around in a way that even in like Google Docs, for example, can click and drag on images. Like, but I hate doing it. Like, it doesn't feel good to do it. Keynote, I'm constantly shuffling stuff. The nesting works so well with tabs and shift tabs to unnest stuff. The Apple really nailed something about tactility in Keynote. To me, it feels the closest to like having a wall on the computer, you know, in the same way you can move, you know, note cards around on like a blackboard or whatever. And so then when you have the Keynote kind of outline set, what software do you write in?
It doesn't matter. Sometimes it's text edit. Sometimes like I'm in, you know, Sublime Text, you know, something that I write code in. Sometimes I just sit down and write in that. Just need a mono with font, you know.
Right.
And then I'll like paste it over in Pages or something like that to do a quick grammar check or to make sure that I didn't, you know, misspell a word.
Right. Well, I was just asking because I was wondering, are you bringing the images in while you're writing as well? Are they stuck into the document? Or if you're using Sublime Text, I guess you can't do that.
No, I can't do that. So yeah, it's sort of interesting because I have the Keynote. I understand how the text kind of fits into the presentation.
Hmm.
So I think all writers read their work out loud. So for me, a lot of times after I write, you know, like the 2-3 paragraphs that I need for this particular idea on the slide, I'll just paste it into the presenter notes and then launch the Keynote presentation in presenter mode and sort of read it out loud that way.
Interesting.
So I think that that's maybe one of the reasons why these visual essays that I've done has such a probably different tone than what I had in the book.
Right.
Right. Because I'm working with different I have different ingredients, you know, I have different tools, and I wrote most of the book and just like, I wrote it in pages because, you know, we wanted to be able to track edits and things like that.
Right.
And it yielded a certain outcome. It was actually a lot easier to write words than to try to get images into it. And if I step into Keynote, or if I just kind of keep things off the computer as long as possible and write things out by hand or shift things around on the wall, it's a lot easier for me to switch between images and words because, you know, if you're holding a pencil, you can draw a cat or write the word cat just as easily with either one. Right. And if I have Keynote open, I can pull in a photo of a cat really easily and just as easily as making a slide that says the word cat.
Right.
And you can't do that necessarily in something like Word or Pages or, you know, like a plain text editor.
I think sometimes people get too obsessed with like finding one piece of software that allows you to do everything. And it's nice to hear that you have this kind of messy process that involves so many different moving parts.
Yeah. I mean, it's nice. The other good thing about, I guess, having so many of the reference points or ideas about the thing that you're working on around you in the physical space is that you just sort of get to sit in it, you know, and it's very difficult to sort of reproduce that inside of a digital environment as well.
It is. It's so hard to come close in any way to replicating what you get with a wall, you know, and I felt that I was doing a residency in Virginia in December last year. And one of the features of my studio was this giant wall. I mean, it was like, you know, like a 20-foot long wall that I could just use the whole thing. And it's, you know, 30 feet higher. I mean, it was just this huge wall. And when I came back to Japan, I realized immediately I need a wall in my life. Mm-hmm. I really, you know, and all the apartments I'd lived in before were too austere to have a wall at that size. And so when I was working on big projects, I'd have to go to friends' design studios and kind of borrow their floors and stuff. But having that wall and having a thing covered in ideas that you are forced to walk past or confront every day is so powerful.
Yeah, you're probably like, I don't feel like I'm actually working in an interesting or good direction unless I look like a crazy character in like a David Finch film, you know? Cause like his, like everybody who works in a David Finch film, they just like have their work spread all around them.
Yeah.
And they look absolutely manic because the film camera can't pick it up because you can't see it. And that's the same problem with the computer. It's like, well, if I'm kind of pacing around my studio or around my apartment and I've got this stuff up, like I can see it whether I want to look at it or not. Like I don't need to have the will to pull it up. It's just there.
Well, and it's not only just there, but it's also inviting you to like remix it. In a way that digital stuff that feels like there's a weird friction because you can't see the macro view of a lot of things at the same time. Like you can't see all of your slides in Keynote simultaneously. So moving a bunch of slides from the top to the bottom is actually, it's kind of onerous, right? It's a big deal. Whereas if you've got your board, you can make a mess in a way that you understand how the mess has been made that I think invites you to make more of a mess. And it's in making that mess that you come up with your most interesting connections and ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. 100% agree with that.
Getting back to Kickstarter book stuff, you know, you said that Robin was kind of an inspiration for The Shape of Design. And I was going back through the last few years, really the last 8 years, I guess, of books on Kickstarter. And I was shocked to see that Robin's was so early and so long ago now. You know, it's August 2009 that he launched his Robin Writes a Book campaign.
That was 8 years ago. Yeah.
And what I love about it is it's like Robin writes a book. He does a little Kickstarter 8 years ago. He raises, I mean, this is when Kickstarter was in its total infancy. You had to email Kickstarter and send a proposal in, which was like editing a text file and kind of beg to be allowed to put a campaign up on the site, and they would bless you and allow you to put the thing up there. And even with all of the weird sort of friction between wanting to do it and doing it, Robin put this thing up there, and no one really knew what Kickstarter was then, but he managed to get 570 people to pledge $14,000 for Robin to write a book.
I'm writing a book. I'm writing a book.
I'm writing a book.
I'm writing a book. I'm writing a book. So I've had a few really great experiences when it comes to books and publishing this year. First of all, there were the short stories that I published for the Kindle and for the web. It got just a really warm, encouraging response. And then, of course, there was New Liberal Arts, the collaborative project that I did with a bunch of other people over at Snark Market. And both of these were so much fun and just so sort of gratifying that I figured it was time to take the next step. And I think that's to write a book, a short book, because I think that's what's reasonable for me to write and also reasonable for you to read. I have this nightmare of finishing some 500-page tome that even my friends can't get.
Like, it's incredible to think that that was 8 years ago. And, right? And like, it's so endearing. But it's also interesting to see that drums as music for Kickstarter videos is a thing, and it's been a thing for 8 years.
You know,
I remember seeing this video and just going, and I had never met Robin. I met Robin like maybe a year and a half after he put this thing up. And I remember seeing this and just being like, who is this dude? And like, wow, man, like what guts it takes to put this thing out there.
Yeah, absolutely. But that video is completely Robin. Right. Just like very, like enormously cheerful, very smart and funny, and completely like one of the most affable people that you'll ever meet.
Yeah.
And I think the charming thing about it is that he's not really even talking to people that he doesn't know. Right.
Right.
So like he doesn't even introduce himself. He's just like, here's a guy, and he sort of pops up from the bottom of the frame and he says, I'm making a book.
Right.
And that's kind of enough,
yeah,
for the people who already knew about Robin and like the couple things that he mentions in the video. Yeah, Kickstarter is a lot different now because people are trying to maybe also speak to people that they don't know. But it's nice that the core of it, the heart of it, has pretty much always been there.
It's just so gutsy, right? I mean, this is 2009. No one's really done a book on this thing before, and to just go, I'm going to write a book, guys. And it wasn't even done.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, he was in the middle of writing it. Like, it's like ultimate gutsiness, you know? And then I love the kind of like looking back at the history of Robin now. It's like, okay, he does this in 2009. And then he has an international like bestseller come out a few years later. It's like,
yeah, exactly. Exactly. The book that like follows me around, that I always kind of smile whenever I see it at a bookstore in an airport,
yeah,
or like on the front table at the indie bookshop, you know?
Yeah.
It's amazing. And then, I think later on this year, his second novel is coming. Well, his second, published novel,
yeah,
by, you know, like a big name publisher.
Sourdough. So, it's coming
Sourdough
out.
Sourdough from FSG.
I've read it. It is so much fun. It is just pure Robin fun. And he's also like the most San Francisco positive writer working today. Like it feels like to me. I don't read much about San Francisco outside of tech news, and it's always dour and like really kind of grim. And then Robin's books, like I want to go to the San Francisco and Robin's books. I feel like Robin was secretly a consultant on Big Hero 6 or Big Hero 5. What was the name of that movie?
Yeah, that sounds right. I didn't see it.
Big Hero something, where it's like San Francisco and Tokyo melded together in like the most awesome possible way. You know, just looking back at this project, it was just a shock to see that it was 8 years ago and that it did as well as it did. And actually, the number of people is really impressive. 570 people is a lot of people to get to pledge to something. And then after Robin, in my mind, it had come a lot later, but actually it was just like a month later, Scott Thomas launched the Designing Obama book, which then at that time raised $84,000, which was just unthinkable, right? I mean, it was just
astronomical, right?
What? Yeah. You could get $80,000 for an indie book pre-published on Kickstarter from a bunch of people you don't know. 1,312 backers for that one. I felt like that was the first design book to come out of Kickstarter.
Oh yeah. I have work in Designing Obama. That's why I got a copy of it.
There you go.
Yeah. So I actually didn't back it. I should have, but I got a copy because I had a couple posters in there. Yeah. That was huge because I think people didn't really quite understand like the range of possibilities,
right,
with crowdfunding at that point. To actually have like a dollar sign associated with it actually made it more impressive, right? So it was just sort of playing on the Obama gravy train, right? And just sort of like we're just gonna like ride this cloud and this rainbow into infinity of pure bliss, right?
It was just...
like publishing is different. We can make these amazing giant books filled with, you know, graphic design and posters and things and like raise $80,000 and, you know, wee.
I think around that time, like literally if I just saw the word Obama, I started shooting money out of my pockets at it.
Yeah.
But I mean, this was an incredible book and it's sad that money legitimizes stuff, but it felt like this really legitimized Kickstarter, the platform, as a place to do serious big books. I mean, this is a book that Tashen could have put out, but Scott Thomas decided, I'm going to do this on my own in the spirit, I guess, in the spirit of the campaign in a certain way. This was around the time that I applied to be able to do ArtSpace Tokyo on the platform. So between applying and actually launching ArtSpace Tokyo, we took about 8 months. We applied, we got accepted, and then we didn't launch for 8 months. We were just trying to get everything ready for that, prepared for that. But this was when Kickstarter really hit my radar after having done my indie books on my own as a co-publisher for 6 or 7 years and going, oh my God, this makes so much more sense than hoping your distribution channel is going to sell these books that you're kind of producing on a prayer here. And it just felt like it made a lot of sense economically. It made a lot of sense in terms of the ecosystem in a way that, you know, no other funding platform had done before.
Yeah. And before this, it was difficult because you were putting a lot of money at risk.
That's just what so, I like, mean.
Even to get the presses started, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, if you want to, let's say, you know, what was this? This was 2008. Was that the year, right?
2009.
2009. If you wanted to, say, make a film or a short film, right? You could go recruit friends, ask for favors, shoot it on a DSLR, and the cost of production would be pretty much zero because at that point you can find different places to distribute that video.
Well, yeah, right? you had YouTube, right?
Yeah, like YouTube, you could stick it on YouTube and it could live there, or you could put it on Vimeo and it could get featured. But with indie books, one of the issues was if you wanted it to take like a physical form, like people expect a book to do most of the time, it was pretty expensive at that point to actually get the presses started. You know, you needed at least several thousand dollars to get going. And if you wanted to produce like something that seemed to be a special artifact, like say a big art book about Obama, or, you know, like a very well constructed and considered precious smaller book like ArtSpace Tokyo, that takes coin. And it's really risky to put your own money up for something like that, especially when the audience is so speculative.
Well, especially considering for a lot of books to reach a really big audience in the bookstore universe, you had to be out on the front table, right? Like if you weren't on that front table, you basically didn't exist. And right. That also cost money. And to get on the table, you had to have a relationship with like Barnes & Noble. And that required being part of a big publishing network or having a big distributor. The Perseus sales rep had to go in there and fight for you. And so you had to convince the Perseus sales reps that you were worthwhile. There were so many hurdles between producing the book that you wanted to produce and then getting it to the people that you thought might like it and doing it in a mildly efficient way, and the amount of cost required to be put up front for that to happen, and then not even knowing if anyone was going to buy it in the end.
Yeah, exactly. Doing all of that and still not being certain if there's an audience for your book that are interested in this thing that you just maybe spent years of your life working on.
Right. And possibly, you know, like $100,000, depending on how many you made or how big it was or how complicated it was, you know, and how much promotion you bought from the bookstores or whatever. I mean, like the amount of money up front could be bananas. Whereas on Kickstarter, designing Obama is kind of this first example of doing a risky book in a way that there was no risk.
Right. Exactly.
A risk-free, risky book. And then 2011, you do your book, you raise $100,000. And then last year in 2016, I think one of the most amazing things to come out of Kickstarter, which was the confluence of normalization of the platform, normalization of crowdfunding, like this idea of crowdfunding as being a thing that, yeah, you just kind of do. There's GoFundMe campaigns and there's Indiegogo campaigns. And you kind of see it all over the place. That all coming together, plus the production of books being easier to do and distribution through Amazon and all these other channels being easier to access, coming together as Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls by Francesca and Elena over at Timbuktu Labs. That was incredible to see that happen. This kind of thing that rode a tidal wave of promotion to $1 million in sales on crowdfunding. It was just incredible to see that.
That total is flabbergasting.
It's unbelievable. I mean, they raised $675,000 in the Kickstarter campaign and then transitioned to Indiegogo, where they went, you know, over $1 million. And they announced last month they've now sold over 500,000 copies around the world, which is just, it's a bonkers number.
Yeah. I mean, that would totally obliterate anything on the New York Times bestseller list.
I don't think it would have sold as well had it not been crowdfunded.
Right.
Like, there's something that happens between the buyers and the sellers. There's an intimacy that happens here that makes you want to get out and fight for the thing in a way that, in a way that just like hearing, oh, hey, you know, Random House is publishing this progressive book of bedtime stories for girls. You kind of hear that and you go, yeah, that's kind of cool. But seeing Elena and Francesca, and I think this is where the power of a good Kickstarter video comes in, seeing them fight for this book, stand in front of you and go, we think this should exist in the world, and doing so in this really beautifully unpolished way. Like the launch videos for this book are quite raw, but they're so endearing. Seeing that makes you want to get out there and scream and like buy 15 copies of it and buy it for everyone you know who has a daughter, you know, and send links to everyone you know who might be interested in this thing and like buy it for libraries. And there's an activation that happens on crowdfunding that I don't think can happen in big publishing, which is really fascinating.
Yeah, it feels like you're making a choice for yourself, right? By participating in helping this thing to exist, you love it more.
Yeah.
Like, no matter what it is, you now have a bond to that thing. And it's just impossible to have a personal story attached to any kind of product that you buy in a normal commercial fashion. And that's kind of like a really interesting experience that I've had back in Kickstarter campaigns, because by the time the thing actually shows up, hopefully, you know, that person has been sort of trickling news about working on the thing. Or, you know, one of the cool things about backing publishing projects on Kickstarter is the excited press check backer update.
Right.
That's probably like one of my favorite modes of writing, because one, obviously the people who are there are tired, but so excited to actually go make this thing real.
Right.
The other is sometimes those people have no experience being on press. You know, so maybe there's like this set of really helpful people who work at the print house, helping them actually make their book a reality. And then the third is that, like, I like it a lot too, because it sort of exposes the process of producing a book at probably its most interesting point, where you're putting ink on paper and it's kind of being flown through this machine at 1,000,000 miles an hour to make a few thousand of whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
So just like having pictures of things like that, that kind of work floating around the internet, possibly being shown to people who would never want to look at that unless it was attached to this object and the story and sort of this little mini movement that they're participating in. That's really exciting to me as a person who, you know, sometimes designs books and works as a designer all the time.
And do you think there's anything Kickstarter can do to crank up the intimacy? Are there features that are being left on the floor now that you think if this existed or if this was part of the follow-up, it would allow even more connection or conversation between the backers and the producers?
I think that there's a whole experience once the project's finished.
Mm.
Being able to maintain the relationship once the project is through, I think, is pretty important. And it feels a little awkward to, you know, whenever somebody launches something new, whether it's through Kickstarter or not, to get a message from that person that's tethered to the project that you backed.
Mm.
So there's that. I think that, you know, there's also the possibility of building out tools to help people share the campaigns once they're over, if those people are interested in continuing to sell
right. The
thing that they've got funded.
Right.
And I think that that's particularly important with publishing.
Right.
Because if I've raised this money and now I'm going to go write this book, and I've got a pretty good hunch that it's going to take me 4 to 6 months to write this book.
Mm.
And I've secured the money that I need to do the print run that I need to fulfill the orders of my backers, then why wouldn't I just keep on selling it? yeah. right? Because the cost of adding another few hundred to the print run and pre-selling those and, you know, getting a little bit more cash in the bank, there's no reason not to do that, because at that point, the risk is pretty much gone.
Yeah. Well, and also books begin once they're done. Like that's when,
exactly.
that's when the real conversation starts, and it feels like Kickstarter is over-optimized for beginning the thing. And then once the thing is real, or once the campaign is done, it feels like all the tools suddenly disappear. They drop off. For me, with doing Koyabound last year, it was just so weird to have Indiegogo reach out and contact me and say, hey, we've cloned your Kickstarter project. Mm-hmm. And the second your Kickstarter ends, we will put it up live for you and you can just keep selling over here. We did that because that was the easiest way to just keep selling the book to keep going. You know, yeah. and it just felt in some ways like we were cheating on Kickstarter. You know, it was it was like, I want to keep giving Kickstarter my money, you know, or their cut of these sales. But yeah, it felt really unfortunate. And then that bifurcates where the conversation can happen and where information is being consolidated and where backer information is being consolidated. And it just feels like that would be nice if it was all under the same hood.
And there's one more thing. So like there's sort of key two points that are very critical. The first is whenever the thing gets funded, right? Yep. Like whenever the campaign ends, if it's successful, that's what we're talking about right now. There's another one, which is when the thing ships.
Yeah.
Right. So if it's like, I don't know, if you spent $80 to get a cooler, or like $700 or whatever right. that ridiculous cooler was on Kickstarter, like your experience after that is like, okay, cool, I got this cooler. But in publishing, everybody who backs it gets the same book at around the same time.
Yeah.
And that is like a de facto book club.
Yeah.
Right? So like why is there so little around the experience of enjoying the things that you've backed together? If you enjoyed the experience of backing it together, is there the possibility of producing ways to allow people to enjoy that thing together?
I suppose this is an argument for doing a book-specific Kickstarter, like a startup that is just focused on helping people make books. Although I think the market cap for that is probably too low to get funding, and you're going to be competing with Kickstarter. But it'd be great if Kickstarter had, you know, maybe three or four different post-funded modes. So you have something post-book, something post-tech product, something post, you know, industrial design. And the follow-up and the tools for the follow-up were different for each of those different spaces. And in the case of a book, like you said, it should be book club time. You know, there should be kind of like a forum space for people to be able to talk about what was in the book, the topics of the book, allow the author to communicate with those people. You know, it's to sort of begin this conversation, which is what, in the best case scenario, a book is great at doing, right? Starting a conversation.
Yeah, it's weird because physical books, they are these enormously social things that exist in space. Like a good bookstore is, it's a social space.
Totally.
You know, it's like you can walk in there and buy the books, but the point of the bookstore is to, you know, chat up the people behind the counter and see what they're reading and maybe mention this thing that you were reading that you enjoyed to see if they have anything else that might be worth your time, or just to sort of like stumble in. Right. The bookstore, a couple blocks from me, they have like a children's book reading, like every day on Saturday morning, like around 10 or 10:30, something like that. So it's like a communal space, and there's readings and those kinds of things. And you can do that in physical space, but I feel like that's maybe something that has been pretty lackluster online.
Yeah.
You know, Goodreads doesn't feel like a community. It feels like Yelp.
It doesn't. I don't know what it feels like. It's
like a lot of very angry people.
It's a place I don't want to spend time for whatever reason. Like it just doesn't feel like a nourishing, positive place to spend time online.
Yeah, and I think that there must be a way to get people together through the internet to enjoy books together.
And I think that's why your point about Kickstarter providing the space is so powerful, because everyone has opted in. Everyone wants this book to succeed if they've backed it. Everyone is there operating from a positive point of view. And to be able to capitalize on that, to have great conversations, feels like a huge opportunity.
Yeah. And I think another thing that it does is it very easily creates value for the people who are putting on the project yep. with no work from them. So what you can then do is, if you want, you can then raise your pledge levels a little bit, you know, tack on a few more dollars, because one of the perks is that now you can participate in the book club,
right?
Because you were one of the original backers.
Right.
We're gonna have this cool space for you to talk about the book. And you know, we'll do like a little AMA with the author or something like that, you know,
yeah.
2-3 weeks after the book ships, so that as you have questions about the text or whatever, like we can just sort of hang out and chat about the things that we find interesting about what we're all enjoying together.
Yeah. If it just feels like there's a lot of opportunity there. Closing loops for projects can be difficult, you know, and I think Kickstarter is optimized around focus on just getting the money to make the thing real in the world. And I think that's great, but Kickstarter has been around for, you know, eight or nine years now. And that it doesn't feel like that it has evolved beyond that initial focus, for better or for worse. And so then you end up with Indiegogo, or you end up with BackerKit, or you end up with these other spinoffs picking up the baton once the thing is done in a way that feels overly complicated. It would just be nice to keep it all in the same place.
Yeah.
In a positive
exactly.
way.
Exactly. Exactly. And that happens with a lot of online platforms. They eventually figure out that, oh, we built this thing and people are using it. And one of the main ways that we can add value to the people on our platform to make their lives easier and for our company to make a little bit more money is to actually step into seller services or building out features to, you know, help support the people who are actually succeeding using the thing that we made. So this is people like Etsy or Shopify making shipping features and postage a lot easier for people,
right.
or inventory management or whatever.
Right.
And it seems kind of crazy that Kickstarter hasn't gone too far down that road yet.
Yeah. I mean, I realize it's really complicated, obviously. And, you know, focus is good. But it's kind of at the point now where we're ready for those features on the platform. And we kind of, you know, we understand the core of what's there now, and it wouldn't confuse us. And I think it would just bring more positivity and benefit to the community. But what's fascinating about now as a time for doing these things is just how totally normalized doing books on Kickstarter is, and how normalized it is to like get $100,000 for a book now. Designers and Books is such a cool group. Done 2 books in the last year, which have both raised over $100,000. One of their books, The Bolted Book Facsimile, an exact copy of De Perro Futurista, $250,000. It's pretty amazing for this kind of reproduction of an old design classic. And then just a few months ago, earlier in 2017, Jan Shipchase's, you know, the Field Study Handbook, raising, you know, over $300,000. It's so amazing that all of these systems of crowdfunding becoming normalized, people being willing to put in big amounts of money, trusting that they're going to get the thing that's being presented to them. People understanding how to frame projects now in a way that maybe we didn't know how to do it 6 years ago. And also understanding what point in the process to launch the project, right? So like Jan launching when the thing was totally done and just saying, look, as soon as this campaign ends, you're going to have a book in 2 weeks. That's pretty powerful. But all of these systems and then distribution systems and Amazon fulfillment becoming more and more of an easily accessible thing. It's just like everything is in place now for people to produce great books, beautiful books, without having to go through the rigmarole of hoping that a publisher takes them on and waiting years for the thing to get produced.
Yeah. And, you know, it feels like maybe right now we're sort of another inflection point because crowdfunding is so normalized.
Yeah.
I was kind of, you know, we had on the calendar that the two of us were going to talk, and I got interested in Patreon. So I was like clicking around Patreon. Right. And they have models on Patreon where you just send people money that you're, you know, supporting every single month, and they don't necessarily have to do anything.
Right. Right.
Which is kind of amazing because it's become so normalized that you're just sort of like, I'm just going to send this person who makes things that I like $3 a month.
Yeah.
And they do have things where it's like you pay them every time that they ship something, you know, like they release a new video or there's a new comic strip or something like that. But I think it just speaks to how normalized this whole mode of support and commerce has become, that essentially the transaction in that case, it's almost like a retroactive thank you
Yep.
Where it's just sort of like an investment in a person, and it's completely removed from the idea of producing a particular project or artifact or anything.
The specificity of the output is kind of becomes irrelevant.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. It's like they're going to do something interesting, or I think that it's sort of common knowledge that there's high possibility of a Kickstarter campaign turning into a burden for a lot of people at this point. So now what's sort of happening is people are taking on strategies to try to avoid that, right? So like Jan essentially doing everything before launching the Kickstarter campaign, right? Or possibly producing these modes of being able to offer support and just sort of completely dissolving the connection between the product and the financial backing is interesting. Not everybody can do that, and not everybody is willing to do that, but it's interesting that it exists and that there's enough people on both sides of that equation who find that acceptable.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Yeah, it is kind of amazing. And the Patreon model is fascinating for me because I think it also speaks to the fact that we've normalized the acknowledgement that making stuff requires money. It requires time. It requires support. You know, I think we've seen this in newspaper pledges because of political stuff. So people subscribing to New York Times or Washington Post or whatever, but also just, you know, more generally, you know, people subscribing to the New Yorker because they want to see the New Yorker continue to make New Yorker stuff forever. And then scaling that down to the individual producer, like the guy who does Every Frame of Painting, you know, every time the Every Frame of Painting guy,
Tony,
every time Tony puts out a video, he gets $8,000.
Yeah. Yeah. And he hasn't done one for, I was looking through my YouTube subscriptions.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to watch like a new Every Frame of Painting.
Yeah.
And I've got like a couple other subscriptions on YouTube that are sort of in that similar genre. And I realized that I think it's been like maybe 6 or 7 months since he's put one out.
Yeah.
But that's fine.
Right.
It's like he's doing other stuff. I think, I feel like I subscribe to Filmstruck. It's like the streaming service from Turner Classic Movies and the Criterion Collection. And they have bonus features around a lot of the films that they have. And there's one, I swear it's him. I don't know if it's him, but I swear it's him. Like the editing looks a lot like what he would do.
Right.
And the voice sounds very similar. Mm. I swear it's him. I think he's moonlighting, man.
he's cheating on us. I'm a Patreon backer. Come on, Tony, we're waiting for you. No, but like, you know, being able to reliably get $8,000 every time you produce something that takes an incredible amount of time and effort.
Yeah.
That's an amazing situation for a creative person to be in that 10 years ago was impossible to imagine because the normalization of supporting someone, it's like intellectually, I think this is where this is the important point. Intellectually, we've always understood that it takes money to make stuff. But what's happened from these systems and from Kickstarter and GoFundMe and Indiegogo is that they've normalized the experience. So it's no longer just this intellectual activity of thinking, oh, I need to give money to things for things to exist. It's doing it once, doing it twice, doing it 3 times, doing it 10 times. That becoming embedded in your psyche as, it is required to give money to make a great thing in the world. And then Patreon kind of coming along and saying, hey, let's generalize that for people who are doing a whole bunch of different kinds of creative activities, which may or may not result in an object that you can buy. And it's really exciting. I think it's a really exciting, really inspiring time to be making this stuff right now. Especially books.
Especially books, because movies are cool, but books are the best.
Books, you could be an introvert hermit and make them. Movies require most of the time you to talk to another human being, which is not, you know, always at the top of the list of things people want to do.
Unless it's a podcast.
Unless this is two introverts talking about book stuff on a podcast. Well, thank you, Frank, for taking the time. It was great to chat and hope to see you soon in New York City.
Of course. Come see me. Well, buy some books and see some movies.
And eat some pizza.
Pizza.
Today we're talking with Frank Chimero, whose middle name rhymes with Ford Escalade. I just want to use the dramatic piano. Hi, Frank.
Really? hi, Craig. Please put that in. Like, maybe just do that as a bumper at the end or something.
We're done.